Before we do anything else, I'd like to welcome our guests. I believe Neil Wannup is in the room, so welcome, Neil. A couple of housekeeping issues before we start the evening's proceedings. First of all, this meeting is being recorded, so if you are making comments tonight, please state your name clearly. Secondly, the fire alarm for this building is a siren alarm. So should this go off during the evening, please make your way calmly and efficiently, my speaker notes tell me, to the assembly point, which is the jam house. Out the front doors, turn right, and it's on the right. Further point about CPD, anyone wishing to claim CPD for this evening, please can we note there's a slight change in arrangements. Now you're responsible for recording the CPD on your own record. The staff no longer do this for you. But if you could ensure that you have signed the forms outside, please. Those are necessary for audit purposes. And finally, can I ask you to turn off mobile phones and BlackBerries, as both interfere with the sound system. It's not sufficient just to mute the ringing tone, as your phone or BlackBerry will still try and talk to the base station, and this is picked up by our equipment. One final thing to talk about before we get on with the presentation, I'm delighted to welcome Donald MacLeod to this meeting. Donald was the winner of the March Ronnie Sloan Prize, so I'd like to ask him to step forward so I may present him with his certificate and prize. Donald. Right, this evening's business, a presentation on insurance accounting, a new era. I've got Darren Clay and Cameron Ferrugi on my right hand side. They are going to do the introduction and positioning of the paper. Darren is currently with Group Finance and Standard Life, and he's their actuarial manager for IFRS and EEV. He's been involved with financial reporting throughout his career. And since joining the group finance function in 2006, he's been heavily involved with both embedded value and IFRS reporting, and he's a member of the actuarial professions working party on IFRS. Cameron is a senior consultant at Towers Watson, and he's been there for 13 years now. Again, he's been specialising in a variety of global life financial and regulatory issues for the last few years. So without further ado, I'll open the floor to Darren and Cameron. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gordon. Good evening, everyone. Thanks a lot for coming. Just give a bit of a brief background about the working party and the work we did. This working party was set up by the actuarial professions LifePEC back in the summer of last year. And the idea was to everyone was very conscious that the insurance contracts exposure draft was about to come out, and the idea was to write a paper in response, a sort of education paper and a paper for everyone, and the paper covering that exposure draft, but also other recent developments affecting insurers, key issues for life insurers coming out of international accounting developments. Looking at the proposed IFRS developments and comparing that with Solvency II and also more consistent embedded values, and also thinking from a sort of future role of supplementary reporting point of view. This slide provides a link to the paper. I'm sure you've all read the paper in depth, as we'll see in a moment, but just in case one or two of you haven't had the chance yet, please feel free to do so. Just to thank a number of groups, a couple of groups not on this slide. Thanks to the staff at the ISB, we found the staff at the ISB extremely engaging. Sort of a number of people in the insurance contracts project came to one of our meetings, and they worked with us to help present to various actuarial groups, including the November Life Conference and highlights of the Life Conference earlier this year. And they were really keen to listen to what we as an actuarial profession had to say, and so very engaged and trying to get feedback on the exposure draft and trying to incorporate it into their work more currently. Thanks to another group of reviewers of our paper, in particular Derek Wright, our UK representative at the International Actuarial Association, or IAA's Insurance Accounting Subcommittee, who also helped draft the IAA's response to the IASB. And a couple of other reviewers, Peter Wright and Nick Dexter, two members of our LifePEC, who have taken such an active role in keeping our members informed of accounting developments over the last few years. And those two have written a series of notes in recent years that are on the actuaries.org website. And these three plus Nigel Masters were all actively involved in the drafting of the Institute and Faculty's official response to the ISB on the exposure draft. And we quote from a number of aspects in our paper. And then finally, last but certainly not least, all 13 members of our working party named on this slide. And I would say this is the second working party paper I've been involved with. And this paper, all 13 members were very actively involved in helping to draft the paper. And not surprisingly, these 13 also had their day jobs, and you know, a lot of this was actually happening in quite a busy financial reporting year end. Special thanks to Darren Clay, who we'll hear from in a moment. I know Darren personally took the time to fly down to London quite a lot to attend in person. And also to Anthony Coughlin, who I know is here today. Anthony was also very actively involved and presented with me in London back in April. And Darren and Anthony helped sort of put these slides together as well. So the rest of this presentation will cover an overview of the paper, just for the benefit of a small number of you who haven't had a chance to read it yet. So what will we cover? Well, in a moment, Darren will summarise where we are today with international financial reporting standards and the main IASB proposals affecting insurance companies. And then you will then consider the implications, focusing on life insurers, UK life insurers. But you'll see from his description that a number of issues go wider, extending to companies from all countries, some more of a global issues, and also to, some of them to non-life insurers as well. And just to note, the paper summarised the contents of the exposure draft, which was published last July, and took account of subsequent developments up to the end of January this year, which includes a number of bodies presenting their comments on the paper. But in certain areas, there have been significant developments in just the last few months, with new tentative decisions by the IASB as they digest the comments letters and come up with revised views before the standard is finalised. And Darren will be updating us on these latest developments throughout his presentation. And then at the end, I'll briefly come back summarising our working party's conclusions and considering speculating on a possible future role of supplementary reporting. Thanks. Over to Darren.
Okay, thanks, Cameron. One apology, I am losing my voice, so if it goes, I do apologise. If you need me to speak up, please say. First, we must consider the existing IFRS framework. The simplified diagram illustrates the balance sheet for an insurer, together with some of the most relevant IFRS accounting standards that are currently effective. So if we start with the assets, IAS 39 Financial Instruments Recognition and Measurement. On the asset side of the balance sheet, IAS 39 is the key standard. Financial assets are classified into a variety of categories, and the classification determines how the assets are measured, for example at fair value or at amortised cost, and how changes in the measurement are reflected in the financial statements. So do they go through the profit and loss or through equity on the balance sheet, etc. For UK-based insurers, most financial assets are at fair value, with all changes in measurement reflected through the P&L. Moving to contract liabilities, IFRS 4 for insurance contracts represents a culmination of phase 1 of the IASB's insurance contracts project. It applies to those contracts with significant insurance risk or contracts with a discretionary participation feature, whether they transfer significant insurance risk or not. Consequently, IFRS 4 is applicable to most with-profits contracts. IFRS 4 permits the continuation of many existing accounting practices, and hence there's substantial variation throughout the world, and this is one of the drivers of the Phase 2 project. For UK-based life insurers, excluding bank insurers, this can be summarised at a high level. As for non-profit business, the FSA regulatory regime is followed, removing contingency reserves and setting up a DAC asset to reduce new business strain. And for with-profit funds, The FSA realistic regime is followed, removing shareholder transfers, holding a VIF, and for non-profit business within the fund, and setting up an unallocated divisible surplus liability for funds whose allocation between policyholders and shareholders has not been determined. IAS 39 and IAS 18 revenue. For contracts that don't meet the criteria for IFRS 4, then IAS 39 and IAS 18 are relevant. So for example, a unit-linked investment contract would be separated into a financial liability under IAS 39, measured at fair value with a deposit floor, which typically would be the bid value of units, and an investment management services component under IAS 18, where acquisition costs and front-end fees are deferred and recognised as services are provided. Only acquisition costs incremental at the contract level are deferrable. The key standards, IFRS 4, IAS 39 and IAS 18, as highlighted in green, are all undergoing major review, which we now consider. The insurance contracts exposure draft is proposed to replace IFRS 4, and we'll come on to that shortly. IFRS 9 financial instruments will replace IAS 39 and will impact the classification and measurement of financial assets and liabilities. At a very high level, the measurement of financial assets is simplified to either fair value or amortised cost, and the deposit floor remains for investment contract liabilities. The revenue recognition exposure draft will replace IAS 18 and will impact investment contracts. Most notably, it proposed that acquisition costs would no longer be eligible for deferral. This would significantly increase new business strain from writing such contracts. Recent IASB board meetings have started to reconsider this proposal following comments received during the exposure period. In addition, there is a new standard being developed which will determine the fair value of financial assets and liabilities, and so impact the measurement of insurers' assets and investment contract liabilities. There are two notable points. The core principle for fair value is the price that would be received to sell an asset or transfer a liability in an orderly transaction between market participants at the measurement date. And the fair value of a liability should reflect the effect of non-performance risk, i.e. own credit risk. We'll come back to these two points later on. Now focusing for the remainder of the presentation on the insurance contracts exposure draft as published in July 2010, which is the primary topic for the Working Party paper. It proposes a single measurement model for all insurance contracts consisting of the following components. Firstly, the discounted probability weighted estimate of the fulfilment cash flows. The concept of probability weighted means that stochastic techniques may be required to capture material asymmetries, which is similar to the expected requirements of Solvency II. Current and entity-specific assumptions are used for non-market variables. And unlike investment contracts, there is no deposit floor. The discount rates are to be consistent with observable market prices for instruments with cash flows whose characteristics reflect the liability. There is explicit reference to including an illiquidity premium. Secondly, there is an explicit risk adjustment, defined as the maximum amount the insurer would rationally pay to be relieved of the risk that the ultimate fulfilment cash flows exceed those expected. The ED permits only three measurement techniques: cost of capital, confidence interval, and conditional tail expectation. The risk adjustment is calculated at the portfolio level, and so excludes the effect of diversification between portfolios. And finally, the residual margin, which is separate from the risk adjustment. The residual margin is set to eliminate an accounting gain at inception of an insurance contract. A negative residual margin is not permitted, and in such an event, a loss at inception of the insurance contract would be immediately recognised. The residual margin is determined within a portfolio by a similar date of inception and period of cover. And the residual margin is earned over the coverage period. So the ED proposes no subsequent remeasurement, and all changes in experience from day two onwards of the contract flow directly through profit or loss. In other words, there is no use of the residual margin as a shock absorber. We also note that for short duration contracts, that is contracts where the coverage period is approximately 1 year or less, the ED requires a UPR approach for the pre-claim liabilities, while post-claim liabilities follow the building block approach. Moving on to a review of the measurement model and the mechanics of the building blocks. If we look at the measurement approach, many existing insurance accounting models have elements of both a deferral and matching and an economic value approach. A deferral and matching approach allocates revenue and expenses in accordance with the provision of risk coverage or services and is more focused on the income statement. An economic value approach measures the value generation to shareholders arising from the sale of contracts and is more focused on the balance sheet. The fulfilment value model of the ED is a hybrid between the two approaches, as demonstrated by the examples listed, and as it is a hybrid model, care will be required by users to interpret the results. Volatility and discount rates. The most common concern expressed on the ED is that its adoption would lead to unrepresentative short-term fluctuations, i.e. volatility, and reported IFRS profits, which does not reflect the fundamentals of long-term insurance business. Volatility can broadly be considered as a mixture of accounting and economic mismatches. Accounting mismatches can arise from different asset and liability measurement approaches under IFRS, and economic mismatches are perhaps truer mismatches between assets and liabilities, reflecting risks taken by the insurer, which could be addressed by additional disclosure to explain the result or by reducing the mismatches in practice. However, the dividing line between these two types of mismatch is often not clear-cut. A number of potential approaches have been put forward by the industry to mitigate some of the observed volatility in the ED, including subsequent remeasurement of the residual margin for non-economic assumption changes. This would reduce volatility to the extent that the residual margin exists. A cost option, which would permit a locked-in discount rate for certain defined liabilities. The discount rate would be set at inception, and for consistency, the backing assets would be measured at amortised cost. Through the use of presentation, in particular through the use of other comprehensive income, rather than taking all changes in contract liabilities to net income, this approach would remove volatility from certain key performance indicators. And finally, through the discount rate. The ED was interpreted by many observers as permitting only a bottom-up assessment, that is a risk-free rate plus an illiquidity premium. However, a top-down approach based on a replicating portfolio of assets allowing for expected credit default and maybe the credit risk premium could reduce mismatches between assets and liabilities. All four potential approaches have been discussed in recent IASB meetings, with only the cost option being tentatively rejected. We also considered in the working party four further mismatches. Fair value and the orderly transaction. As noted earlier, the fair value of measurement ED has a core principle that market prices need to be from an orderly transaction. The insurance contracts ED requires calibration to observable market prices, but does not mention the concept of an orderly transaction. Therefore, there would appear to be the potential for an accounting mismatch between insurers' assets and liabilities in certain circumstances. This could be resolved by aligning the two proposals. Non-performance or on credit risk. The ED explicitly does not permit insurance contract liabilities to reflect on credit risk. While full allowance is possible in the measurement of backing assets at fair value, and reinsurance assets. This is a challenging subject where both points of view are put forward in section 5.6 of the paper. Some respondents to the ED raise this as a subject for further analysis. The paper does recognise that it is debatable whether this is an accounting or economic mismatch. Illiquidity premium. In extreme market conditions, when the illiquidity premium is large, the impact on the discount rate and the measurement of liabilities will be significant. Insurers who do not own illiquid assets may be forced to recognise the accounting benefit without being able to capture the illiquidity premium in practice. This is the issue that forced a number of pension schemes to show a much reduced deficit or even a surplus at the end of 2008, which appears a slightly odd accounting result in the midst of the financial crisis. It is debatable whether this is an accounting or an economic mismatch. And taxation. Finally, there remains potential inconsistencies between the IAS 12 approach to measure deferred tax assets and the ED approach to contract liabilities. For example, there is no discounting permitted in IAS 12, and the historic issues in this context of UK unit-linked business remain as noted by our profession's response to the ED. Moving to the risk adjustment, the core principle described earlier appears to imply an exit value rather than a fulfilment value concept. The ISB appears to have accepted this point and has tentatively revised the principle as noted on the slide. In addition, excluding the effect of diversification between portfolios is not consistent with how such business is valued and managed and is at a lower level than permitted in QIS 5. And residual margin. The low level of granularity increases the likelihood and potential level of day one losses. In addition, the complexity is increased as all other components of the contract liability, for example the risk adjustment, will need to be measured at the same granularity. The residual margin is earned over the insurance coverage period, either on the basis of the passage of time or is significantly different the expected timing of incurred claims and benefits. The amortisation pattern has the potential to be significantly different to the provision of service and other unintended consequences as considered in the paper. Now moving from a review of the measurement model to a number of other issues arising for UK life insurers from the insurance exposure draft. Firstly, the timeline. This slide contains the timeline over the next 4 years for IFRS and Solvency II. As you can see, this year is crucial with the finalisation of various IFRS standards. It will be important that the effective date of these changes are synchronised to avoid the requirement for multiple transitions and restatements, and the ISB is currently undertaking a project on this matter. The ISB staff recently provided a tentative recommendation to the board that the date of mandatory adoption of the insurance contract standard should not be before the 1st of January 2015. With the publication of the draft Omnibus 2 directive setting the effective date of Solvency II to be the 1st of January 2013, it is therefore highly likely that Solvency II will be effective before a new insurance contract standard. This will present a range of practical challenges and considerations for insurers during the interim period, as IFRS 4 is often based in the UK on the FSA return valuation, which will be redundant. Reporting options for insurance contracts in the interim period could include maintaining the current approach and parallel running two sets of models, adopting Solvency II adjusted or unadjusted under IFRS 4, or early adopting the requirements of the new insurance contract standards, or adopting under IFRS 4 as an improvement to the existing accounting policy. In addition, the changes by HMRC to the taxation regime during the interim period and thereafter will be another consideration for insurers. Moving back to the technical matters and the issues arising for UK life insurers and the transitional arrangements, the arrangements at the point of transition to the new insurance standard are that the contract liability is defined to be the best estimate plus the risk adjustment without a residual margin. The change from the existing IFRS contract liability is released to shareholder equity, and consequently the amount will never be recognised through the income statement. The loss of these future profits could be substantial, as existing IFRS liabilities are expected in many cases to be larger than the best estimate plus the risk adjustment. There has been much industry comment on the transitional arrangements, and the ISB has indicated that this aspect of the exposure draft is likely to change. Our working party welcomes this indication. The most common suggestion during the comment period was to permit full retrospective application, perhaps on a best efforts basis. Moving on to excluded expense cash flows. In the exposure draft, the following expenses are excluded from the cash flows used to determine the contract liability. Acquisition costs that are not incremental at the contract level, and general overheads. Incremental acquisition costs are included in the initial contract liability assessment. Such costs act to reduce the initial residual margin, and so can be thought of as a DAC asset embedded in the liabilities, hence reducing new business strain. In recent IASB meetings, it's been proposed that only acquisition costs not incremental at the portfolio level should be excluded. This represents a change from the exposure draft, which was at the contract level, and would move the model closer to current UK practice under IFRS 4. Our working party welcomes this development. General overheads are not contained in the cash flows used to determine the contract liability. As such, they will reduce profit in each year to the extent that the release of the residual margin does not coincide. There is a case for including general overheads, which are incremental at the portfolio level, in the contractual cash flows. Moving on to unbundling. An insurance contract is required to be unbundled into different components where there are components of the contract which are not closely related to the insurance contract. And three examples are provided in the exposure draft. The unbundled components are then valued under the relevant IFRS standards. There are a number of issues to note with this. The term closely related is not defined, and so is open to potential interpretation. For example, do the three examples in the exposure draft take precedent over the principle of closely related? The scope of unbundling is fundamental as it impacts the measurement of the contract liabilities and the consequent recognition of profit. And in addition, there are practical challenges from unbundling. For example, allocating charges and expenses when unbundling an account balance. Contract boundaries. In the measurement model, cash flows are included only to the extent that they are within the contract boundary. In the exposure draft, the contract boundary was triggered by a pricing reassessment at the contract level. This was generally preferred to the Quiz 5 definition, where the reassessment was interpreted to be at the portfolio level. In recent IASB meetings, the contract boundary definition was reconsidered, reflecting comments from health insurers to the exposure draft. Participating business. There are many implications for participating contracts in the exposure draft. One in particular was noted by our profession's response. Paragraph B61J makes reference to cash flows in respect of future policyholders being included in the contract liability. However, this is contradicted in a number of places elsewhere, most notably the contract boundary definition. If, as a consequence of paragraph B61J, the estate is to be treated as a liability, then this would affect the mutual business model, as it is the main source of capital. More generally, further clarification on the treatment of surplus assets and with-profit funds is required to avoid inconsistency within the industry. And finally, coming to presentation and disclosures. We're not able to do this important section of the ED justice due to time constraints, but draw your attention to a few remarks from the paper. The income statement is proposed to be presented using a summarised margin analysis rather than the current traditional revenue account. There will be no volume information, and the approach is more akin to an EV earnings analysis. However, the minimum standard appears to be more focused on the liability side of the balance sheet, rather than capturing the full interactions between assets and liabilities. Reconciliation between the opening and closing contract liabilities is required, and the minimum standard for this reconciliation appears to mix two distinct approaches to such an analysis: an analysis by source of surplus and an analysis by source of cash flow. And in addition, as observed earlier, the risk adjustment can be determined through one of three permitted techniques. To aid comparability, there is a requirement to disclose the confidence level to which the risk adjustment corresponds. The European insurers, this is likely to result in significant additional work, and the benefit is questionable given the theoretical weaknesses in the confidence level method. As a final point, moving from technical to commercial implications and considering the impact IFRS has on new business earnings. Our working party paper provides illustrative pre-tax projected earnings for existing and proposed IFRS for two products: an immediate annuity, as shown here on the slide, and a term assurance. A simple profit test model was used, and for the immediate annuity we observed, there's no day one profit due to the residual margin. There is the possibility for day one loss, given potential differences between the ED discount rate and the pricing discount rate. Non-incremental acquisition costs are expensed at inception. This impact is likely to be less onerous than presented, given recent IASB tentative decisions on acquisition costs, as described earlier. And profit is deferred and released with residual margin over the life of the contract. Overall, only the timing of the profit recognition is altered. I will now hand you back to Cameron to consider the collective conclusions of the working party.
Many thanks, Dan. So what are our conclusions of the IASB's developments? The development of a single insurance liability accounting standard and measurement model applicable globally is a major achievement. Even the FASB are on board, with a similar model being proposed for US GAAP. We welcome that the measurement model includes expected cash flows with assumptions consistent with current market prices and up-to-date entity-specific best estimates. We note that the exposure draft proposals, combined with other IASB developments, provides a framework that can lead to far fewer accounting mismatches than we observe today. But there are a number of issues. The hybrid nature of the exposure draft measurement model will be challenging for users to understand. Significant volatility may arise. Now, there's nothing wrong with measuring and understanding economic volatility. The insurance industry is about taking risk, and with taking risk, you get economic volatility. But there are a number of aspects of the exposure draft and wider IFRS developments where we will end up with volatility, and it will not be clear whether this volatility is economic or accounting related. There is also a debate to be had about whether the primary account P&L, profit or loss account, is the right place to show all the economic volatility. And finally, while we could support the principle of having a risk adjustment, we do not support the specific risk adjustment as put forward by the exposure draft, and we describe a number of issues in the paper. And to be fair, the IASB has been and is addressing several of them with their latest proposals in this area. So where does this leave us in communicating with investors? Chapter 8 of the paper recognises the great work insurance companies have been doing in recent years, better explaining the sources of their IFRS earnings and allowing users to consider how earnings may arise in the future, providing an increased focus on the amount and timing of expected cash flows using existing embedded value models. And this allows companies to communicate wider metrics, such as implied discount rates, internal rates of return, and payback periods. Both IFRS and Solvency II proposals will improve existing practices and disclosures. But a number of items which provide useful insight into aspects of an insurance company's business are missing from both IFRS and Solvency II proposed disclosures. Our working party conclusion is clear. We believe there will be an important role for supplementary reporting in the future. That ends our overview of the paper, and we now look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thank you.
The discussion is now open to the floor. May I invite anyone who wishes to speak to move to, there are microphones on either side of the room by the stairs, or they can come down to the podium. I'm not sure if we have roving microphones tonight. No, there's no roving microphones tonight, so to either side and one down in the podium. Do we have our first volunteer?
My name's Michael Kerr, so I'd like to congratulate the authors on a very comprehensive paper, which I'm sure will be a very good reference source for all of us who've read it. I just had a couple of questions for the authors that they might want to give us their views on. I think Cameron mentioned about the FASB developments, and I was just interested to know how important we thought that getting a common approach for both IASB and FASB, which would bring all the US offices in, how important that was to the success of this project. And my second question was, you showed the interesting graph there on annuity cash flows, and I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on what the commercial impact might be on the annuity market. Do you think companies will actually find the annuity market less attractive, or do you think they'll actually just maintain their existing strategy and pricing for annuities? That's all.
Mr. McGaughey, before you speak, could I just remind everybody that this meeting also can get a prize for the Sloan Award, so I would particularly recommend that some of the younger members can get themselves an award. Mr. McGaughey, I'm not sure if you qualify.
Your point was there going on. Just again,
sort of add my congratulations to the authors for producing a very comprehensive paper. Subject matter was interesting, very detailed analysis, and like a lot of these things, I'm really interested more in the opinions of the authors, and some of that shines through, some of that is more implicit in what's written in here, and also in terms of what was presented, particularly by Darren. There was a number of points talking about the mismatches between driven by the measurement basis and the in the exposure draft. Where you pointed out that it was debatable whether this is an economic or accounting mismatch. Sure, that is debatable. What I'd like to do is wonder if you'd like to give any comments on what you think the actual implications of that are, what sort of behaviours that mismatch will drive, whether it's economic, whether it's accounting. Will it be driving different behaviours in the investment community, or in the actuarial community, or in the wider life insurance industry?
Nobody else? So I've got one question for the authors, if I may then. I was interested in the terminology used for the residual margin, where you were talking about similar time periods and similar periods of coverage. Now, I'm not very close to this area myself, but that almost sounds like your US GAAP approach, where you've got locked in assumptions for different cohort years, but perhaps worse than that, it's within different products and perhaps different terms within different products and no remeasurement. So I'd be interested at some stage if that's the way we're going to have to capture the measurement of multiple generations of products in the future.
Well, Roger Henderson. I suppose I get slightly depressed when I read things that come out from the IASB. I don't know if the authors, or if, I don't know if people in any nation in the world are actually happy with what's proposed, or whether it's just the main achievement is getting a common standard for that could apply globally. I suppose I would have liked to see, I suppose specifically with a UK or European hat on, an attempt at sort of practical consistency between what Solvency II is suggesting and what we're getting in ISB. And so I suppose the thing that I struggle with most is the concept of the residual margin amortization. It's just not something that I find natural or actually helpful, and I don't know if there's any possibility that the ISB will backtrack on that one. One minor point in the paper, and I know it was written against a changing background, it does state in the paper that there was no requirement in Solvency II for analysis of movements, and I've seen templates from SEOPS and later EIOPA, sort of a variation analysis template, and VAC2 looks very much like EEV income statement. And I would have thought that is a good basis for putting, for a starting point for supplementary information in the accounts with hopefully relatively few adjustments, so that people in this room aren't having to calculate multiple numbers to satisfy different purposes. And I suppose when you mentioned the paper, the 6% cost of capital rate, and there may be others, but I would hope that the number of differences between sort of Solvency II analysis of profit and loss and what you put in supplementary accounting might actually be quite limited, and I'd welcome the author's views on that.
One more issue I'd like to inquire about, and it's coming back to the residual margin point, and also coming back to, I think, the basic definition under what's now IAS 39, and the fact that there seems to be this prohibition on recognising any profit on day one. For those of you young enough to qualify for the Sloan Prize, you probably won't remember the achieved profits methodology that the industry tried to find agreement to. But I have to say I philosophically like the concept of matching the amount of profit with the amount of work done. So I've never quite understood myself the prohibition of this recognition of any form of profit on day one. So I'm not sure if the authors or any of the audience could shed some light on that for me. Nothing from the audience anyway. Perhaps the authors of the egg can pick up on that point. Might request some practical feedback from the audience. Mr. Henderson touched on it, but things like allowance for liquidity premium, we must all have had many, many practical difficulties setting the valuation rate of interest for our regulatory returns, and there's been all sorts of theoretical papers about ways that can be done, and all sorts of interaction with the FSA about appropriate ranges. So I'd perhaps ask for contributions as to practicality for this, and if all the folk represented in this room see it as problematic, easy, or what? I'm going to start picking on individuals soon. Mr. Rowe.
Before Gordon picks on me. Just on the practicality, not so much practicality, because there's very little prescription in terms of discount rates and liquidity premium. I think it's going to be hard to get comparability, which must be a focus for any accounting standards, is to try and get comparability, and there doesn't seem to be much that would lead to a very similar view being taken, although possibly in the European market people may use, because it's there, so obviously two things where there will be more comparability. The other point was on participating business, which you referred to, and you referred to the profession raising the question of the estate and not being happy with what's there. But do you have any feeling whether that's going to move and how that's going to move? Because that's very important to a lot of companies, both mutuals and also former mutuals. It's very interesting how with-profits business is treated.
Anthony Faff, as an actuary that's very much steeped in solvency too at the moment, and all the kind of shifting sands that are happening there. There certainly seems to be a growing divergence in certain issues like illiquidity premium and contract boundaries between Solvency II and what is proposed here. I guess it's in the nature of another question. How is that going to impact firms in the kind of context of comparability between figures? Because it seems to me we're creating a mass of figures that are getting harder and harder to interpret or compare.
Do you expect there to be a difference between mismatch between assets and accounting liabilities and mismatch between assets and Solvency II technical provisions? And following the implementation of both regimes, what do you expect to have a greater focus for a company's risk management function? And do you think the Solvency II internal models will be fit for purpose in order to assess potential accounting mismatches as well? And if they're not, does it present problems with the use test?
For myself, I think thought I picked up in the paper that there was no floor anymore. I just wondered about how that squares with what I thought of as a standard accounting concept of prudence. So if the reserve is less than any guaranteed surrender values at any point in time, it does seem as though we don't have to reserve for that shortfall. So I'm interested if my reading is correct there. Okay, well, if there's no more questions, I'll probably like to ask the authors to respond to quite a number of interesting technical issues, and thereafter we'll move to the summing up and closing. Last opportunity for any questions before we do that. Any last questions? I think we'll move to the authors' views and responses to the questions we've had so far. Thank you. Okay. So Cameron's going to do both in the one go. Is Darren also going to contribute? Or double team? No.
To the extent that Cameron wants assistance.
Give me a couple of minutes.
I beg your pardon, folks. I caught Cameron rather on the hop there. So Cameron's going to take a couple of minutes just to consider and discuss with Darren the best way to respond.
While Cameron's thinking through his ideas, maybe I can respond on your residual margins question about cohort years.
That would be useful then.
And I think that's exactly where we view it as being, that because of this having to set the residual margin by similar dates of issue and similar contract durations, you will have to bring the residual margin down to a very small cohort of business that may well be at a year of issue or even below that for certain contract types. And that's where we were coming across in the paper as saying this can require quite a lot of additional work because you'll have to do your residual margins and your best estimates at that level in order to originally be able to set your residual margin. And then you're going to have to track those cohorts of business as far as how your residual margin is expected to run off over time.
Well, joy.
And there was also a question around how the recognition pattern may affect the sale of business in the UK. I'll let Cameron come back more fully on that. But it is possible with the way it's currently defined as expected benefits incurred, for example, that there are certain contract types where the residual margin as it's currently defined could cause significant issues. For example, a whole life contract. How would you actually look at benefits incurred on that basis? Would you end up deferring your residual margin far out into the future and not recognising any profit until well into the expected duration of the contract? So I think there are other contracts, obviously, where that would have a similar approach. I'm not so sure annuities would be one of them in that circumstance, because you would have benefits coming off throughout the lifetime of the contract. So there you may still get a reasonably swift residual margin release. But where you have back-ended benefits, you will have back-ended residual margin releases and back-ended profit recognition.
And again, while Cameron's still thinking, picking up on, I think Mr. Kerr made the point, but Mr. McGaughey certainly did. We're talking different profit signatures here. We're talking different profitability metrics, whether you're looking at some IRR metric or something else. We've also got companies thinking of repricing products based on the Solvency II view of the capital. So interested if anybody involved in the pricing side in the room has had any thoughts about what that means for product profitability, product mix. You will have different profitability metrics depending on the different reporting basis you're looking at. Is that likely to be an issue for anybody? well, and I should apologise because I did drop Cameron in it by cutting the conversation slightly short, so caught him slightly aware. So, just a couple of final housekeeping. If anybody did have any prepared notes to help the staff who are preparing transcripts for the British Actuarial Journal, please could they leave those written notes off with myself or with the staff afterwards. When we do come to the end and have final announcements, we are having a drinks reception afterwards. So if you want to join us all for a glass of wine at that time, you will be very welcome. Just outside on the right where we had tea.
I'm now going to attempt to give some closing remarks and also wrap up a number of immediate responses to hopefully most of your questions. I have a feeling I'm going to miss one or two. I'd just like to start by thanking you all very much for coming, and particularly thanking those who took time to read the paper and provide comments today. I think it's been some very useful questions, comments and challenges, and I think, yeah, this is one of the reasons I think these sorts of events are great. I think in response, and starting with the measurement model, I think we must not forget what progress we've already made in the insurance contracts project when compared with current practice. I think phase two insurance counting will be a big step forward compared with current IFRS. Just to respond to Gordon and Roger questioning the desire for residual margin, I would say in response, I totally understand where we're coming from a sort of UK European insurance actuarial point of view. But also we need to understand where the ISB is coming from. The ISB is a global entity covering a number of areas of the world, many of whom historically have always had an issue with showing a day one profit. And also the global entity covering all sort of listed companies, not just insurance companies. And actually the sort of, you know, historic sort of accounting common theme has been showing a real nervousness about sort of allowing a profit on day one. And I often think this does create an issue because you know, most industries out there are very short term. You quite quickly work out what the true sort of value of new business or income less costs are over days or weeks. And so those are the industries that most counsellors are used to dealing with, and those are the industries that the ISB is used to dealing with. So they end up with a sort of mindset that doesn't necessarily work very well when trying to sort of come up with information that's useful to help make business decisions for an insurance company. And also, I think they end up with a mindset that's to some extent akin to book value accounting. And we must remember that book value accounting has been around for millennia, far longer than fair value accounting or insurance valuations, where we're actually trying to use market information. Historically, there were never any markets. And so this is some of the historical context that we live in. And I understand why the ISB has ended up with this hybrid approach, because on the one hand, they want to fit this framework in with where they're ending up in more short-term industries, and on the other hand, they want something that we will find useful that more fits in with the nature of what we do in valuations. One specific point on participating business, I know Kate Stuart Roper, thank you for raising that. It is a very important topic for the UK insurance industry. It was one of the key items on the agenda for the London Roundtable that the ISB held in December, and it's something I sort of spoke about there very strongly. And one thing I was very glad about is that there are a number of people at that roundtable, mostly coming from continental Europe, and actually a number of continental Europeans also speaking about that issue very strongly. And I think that really helped engage the ISB, because the ISB is a global organisation, and once an issue becomes more than just applicable to one country, I think they take it a lot more seriously. It is a very important subject. Where current accounting is not necessarily in a great place, but I think we've all ended up getting used to it. And I think particularly from a tax point of view, it's something that people feel comfortable about. And I think they were trying to move in a direction where they actually try to understand equity better. But one of the suggestions that the Institute of Faculty of Actuaries sort of response came out with, that we sort of quoted from and brought up again in the London Roundtable, Whereas it's all very well to think of equity and to focus on equity, but it's actually helpful, particularly for participating business, to distinguish between equity that is, you know, doesn't actually belong to anyone, is sort of a notional estate or potentially future policyholders, and equity that shareholders actually have a chance of getting their hands on. Because if we actually end up moving to a situation where all of that counts as equity, then clearly this isn't information shareholders will find useful. They think there's a lot of equity in the participating fund, but actually they're never going to get their hands on most of that. So that was a key point. And Dimitri raised the subject about risk management and to the extent to which risk management should be considering IFRS profits. I think historically, I've worked with a number of companies on risk management, and I'd say historically, if you go back a few years, IFRS was probably not top of the agenda of what the risk management function was looking at or trying to do, and I think that's changing. Risk management has always been an issue, if you look at the Solvency I regulatory point of view, about what do you match to, for example. Do you match to the regulatory position or do you match to a realistic position? This has always been one of the key issues that lower loan functions faced in having to make a decision. Now, in an ideal world, we think that Solvency II is moving to realistic, and therefore, you know, the two should be aligned. I'll come back to Solvency II later. I'm going to cover a number of points on that. But the one thing I've definitely picked up is that the importance of IFRS has gone up in the views of senior management of insurance companies and the views of investors. And so they are looking much more closely at IFRS profits. And I think that's helped drive some companies to say, well, actually, we do need to keep an eye on IFRS profits and understand at least what the risk management decisions are going to do to IFRS profits and what the various risks are. And you know, I'm aware of companies starting to accept that we live in a world with multiple metrics and actually trying to sort of monitor these metrics and what the various risks could do to these metrics. And I'd say IFRS at the moment is becoming one of those, and I think that will continue in the future, even though the metric itself will behave differently to current IFRS. So, well, phase two insurance accounting will be a big step forward. We've made this point a couple of times. The hybrid measurement model is untested, and it will be challenging for investors to understand. And it did take them a while to get to grips with phase one, so we'll face an issue when phase two comes out, but they'll have to take another while to get to grips with phase two. But I would say the desire to consider the perspective of the investors is fundamental to the IASB's philosophy. Witness the objective of financial reporting as set out in the recent draft conceptual framework and quoted in section 2.2.6 of our paper. And this leads to three topics which I'm going to touch on, which I believe we must work hard to get right to enter into a new era of actually engaging with investors in a positive fashion. First, the statement of performance, or the income statement. Second, the link with Solvency II. And finally, supplementary reporting. First, the statement of performance. A number of UK and continental European headquarter multinationals already publish supplementary IFRS earnings using the marginal analysis approach. And this has helped investors better understand the sources of these earnings and improve their forecasting models. But this supplementary information was always intended to complement the premiums and other cash flow information found in current accounting. And I do hope such information does not disappear entirely in the new world. That is also of interest, and I think a clear table in the notes would be fine. But what's not clear to me is how the marginal analysis, combined with a phase two measurement model, will allow users to link IFRS earnings with distributable earnings in anything more than a very approximate way. Because I believe it's the regulatory returns, rather than the primary accounts, that are the primary influence of an insurance company's dividend paying ability, both currently and in Solvency II. And so any link with distributable earnings has to bear in mind the solvency position. And this brings us to the link with Solvency II. We've heard a number of speakers discuss this topic in the context of IFRS developments. Perhaps if I just touch on some of the points. Roger Henson raised a point about the IOPA templates on the analysis and movement. A couple of things to note. One is we were sort of quite careful with words in that aspect of the paper. We sort of made it clear that there was no requirement as yet to publish any analysis and movement in Solvency II. And this is something that's remained unchanged since the Level 1 Framework Directive came out, the draft in 2007, the final Framework Directive, and the draft Level 2 text. And historically, this was not an IOPA or PSIOPS focus. I've engaged with PSIOPS a few times, and historically, PSIOPS, for want of a better word, were rather obsessed about the balance sheet. If you look at some of the early templates that they were proposing, they were requiring an incredible amount of detail on the balance sheets and all these sort of assets held. And actually, early on in their agenda, you didn't really see anything in the analysis of movement. I mean, there was a need, if you're doing an internal model, to produce something internally, potentially provide to the regulator, but it wasn't something they were looking at too closely, particularly from an external point of view. I know this is something the industry has been working hard with IOPA on, A, to get it on the agenda, and B, to actually get it into a form that will be sensible in the new world. And I think it's really the industry that's put this on the agenda, and not IOPA. Anthony Vaff noted the growing divergence in Solvency II and IFRS, and I'll be sort of coming back to that in a moment. Ken Lockie also asked a question about where, in terms of behaviours and risk management, where will we end up with both Solvency II and IFRS? And Kate Stewart-Roper made the point that with IFRS sort of phase two exposure draft being as it is, we will potentially end up with a variety of practices. I'll sort of address these points, but just on Kate's point, I would say that there is a fundamental difference out there between how IFRS has gone down and how Solvency II has gone down. IFRS is very much principles based, and it always has been, and it continues to be in the exposure draft. So today under IFRS, it is all principles based, and we see a variety of practices. Now that does have its disadvantages, but I think in my opinion, we've seen with Solvency II, originally supposed to be principles based, if you go back just even 4 years, the last couple of years become incredibly rules based, and sort of driving companies down very, very detailed ways of implementing it. And then, of course, we have this debate, well, once you have rules, what's the best rules we should have? And we have a lot of bodies having very different points of view on that. And we see just very recently huge changes proposed to certain key aspects of the Level 2 text just from a few months ago. So two different sets of rules which have completely different sort of meanings for what will they do for insurance companies in the Solvency II world. So there are obvious dangers with a rules-based sort of regime, and we've seen issues with that historically with US GAAP. I mean, US GAAP has been incredibly rules-based, and yet it's completely failed to stop some of the some major scandals and major sort of company failures that we've seen over the last decade. So in terms of the sort of growing differences between phase two and Solvency II, I know many of you on your Solvency II projects are involved in lobbying on the Level 2 implementing measures. Well, paragraph 46 of the Solvency II Framework Directive, unchanged on the latest proposed directive, actually instructs the Solvency II standard setters to try and maintain compatibility with international accounting developments to the extent possible. And please feel free to remind your colleagues of this steer, particularly those of you who have direct contact with the standard setters. So moving on to supplementary reporting. Now, Chapter 8 of the paper reminds us of the value of publishing embedded values at a time when I think it's unfashionable in some quarters to make this point. Insurance companies have become much more transparent in their dealings with investors in recent years, showing investors the information that they're using in business planning and day-to-day decision-making, including embedded values in wider cash flow metrics. Anthony Pfaff asked a question about what will IFRS do to, what impact will IFRS have on metrics, what impact will Solvency II have. In terms of Solvency II, it really does depend on where it ends up. How realistic will the Solvency II model be? I think that's still far from certain in terms of a sort of potential need for a central, slightly alternative view on a realistic value. But just as importantly, if not more importantly, the key question with Solvency II is, well, what does this do to distributable earnings? What does this do to some of the other cash flow metrics that companies have started producing so successfully and engaging with investors? And that's something I see sort of nothing coming out directly of the Solvency II requirements to imply. And the companies I've worked with have only recently started to tackle this problem. It is far from straightforward. So I think that's something we have to keep a close eye on in the next few years. Michael Kerr asked about what will IFRS do to the profit test. We saw a certain profit test signature looking completely different. And I think if we end up with that sort of information and that's it from IFRS, then we'll be back to the situation that we were so many years ago, where we don't really have a profit test model coming out of IFRS that in isolation is meaningful, and that to my mind helps strengthen the need for these additional metrics. Going back to a distributable earnings type information on profit test cash flows, I think it's far from certain where we'll end up on that. I mean, the key issues the industry raised have actually been engaged with by the ISB, which is great to see. And it's, we might end up with a very different style of profit test, as Darren alluded to earlier. So to wrap up on supplementary reporting, I think we believe we should be looking at improving supplementary reporting, communicating projected cash flows. But I personally hope and trust that we are planning for evolution in the supplementary reporting, trying to work out what's the best way of communicating information in the post-72 phase two environment, and not abandon it. There's the question I've faced historically is what will 70 do to the need for embedded value MCV? Surely there's no need to do any of this. Personally, I think there's a sort of strong case for continuing with a lot of this information, particularly in the next few years where we're going to have real changes going on. Investors not following this closely, really struggling to understand why things are happening in Solvency II world, why we're being told different things, why are things happening in Phase II world, and yes, why are they different from each other? And that, to my mind, paints a sort of classic case of a need for continuing with supplementary reporting for the next few years, figuring out what Phase II Insolvency II does to the supplementary reporting, communicating that, and certainly not sort of just dropping supplementary reporting. If we drop it, or if we don't get this communication of supplementary reporting right, I can see a serious disengagement with the investor community. To combine these three topics and enter into a new era of communication with investors, I believe we need a supplementary performance statement reconciliation, which builds a bridge between IFRS earnings, the Solvency II analysis of surplus we spoke about earlier, and effectively this sort of bridge should show the analysis of free surplus or free cash flows. And most companies publishing under the EEV or NCEV principles today show a very useful analysis of free surplus. That's something that's definitely led to good engagement with investors. But this format does not provide a direct link with IFRS earnings. So an idea of bridging the gap between these various metrics, explaining what's going on, showing the free surplus sort of analysis and how it links with the other metrics. Now, one possible solution to the supplementary reporting challenge was set out in section 6.2 of the paper, Market Consistent Valuations and Solvency II, Implications of the Recent Financial Crisis, quoted in this paper, referenced in this paper, and presented at Staple Inn last September. I do encourage you to familiarise yourself with this proposal and consider what you think, whether it suffices or whether it can be improved, and feel free to get in touch with your thoughts. But finally, it is refreshing to see that the comments provided and the feedback on the exposure draft has made such an impact on the ISB's recent deliberations and tentative decisions. And I would say to all of you closer to IFRS or sort of Phase 2 and working with your companies to provide feedback, please keep up the good work. Please continue to provide feedback on developments between now and the finalisation of the standard. I believe that the ISB is listening and that it is worth us going the extra mile to make the standard service well for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Cameron. Thank you, Darren. And thanks not just to Cameron and Darren, but to everybody else involved in the working party that pulled that paper together. I wouldn't underestimate the amount of work that took. So thank you very much for a very useful reference document, a good summary, and a very good summing up at the end. So again, my thanks, and thanks to everybody who contributed tonight. One last thing to do before we finish is to announce the next meeting. It's on the